So I think it's a rare privilege for us to hear somebody who has practiced Islam, who has actively interpreted Islam to the West, and comes down here to share his perspective with us. So he will read a little bit from his book and then open it for questions and comments from those of you attending. Thanks again to the Book Cafe for hosting us. They're very terrific to work with and always open our suggestions about possible readers, and that's not true of all the bookstores in Santa Cruz, even the independent bookstores in Santa Cruz, if you can imagine. So it's really great to be here at Capitol Book Cafe. So thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Imam Amer Amrain.
Yeah, don't hesitate to interrupt. I'm good.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you. Thank you, Scott, for your introduction. And before reading from this book, I would like to inform you about my story. I came to the United States in 1966 for the first time, and then I returned back to Iraq within a year. But I fell in love with this country, and I was planning and determined to come back to the United States. And then I was assigned to the Iraqi delegation of the United Nations, and I worked for about 4 years, and I was chairman of subcommittees, vice chairman of the fourth committee of the General Assembly, and I applied for a job with the United Nations Secretariat, and in 1978, I came here to this country to settle forever in the United States, and I am proud of that decision. And my family also, everyone in my family is very happy that we are here and we are Americans and we are part of the American society. The story of this book, after 9/11, I was invited by the Interfaith Council of Contra Costa County to speak on behalf of the Muslim community, and I condemned what happened on 9/11. And I said something which attracted the attention of many people. I said, "Don't let terrorists hijack my religion, Islam, the religion of peace. Solve the chronic issues facing the Muslim world." At that time, the Iraqi people were suffering. 1 million Iraqi children died because of these UN sanctions. And really, this was not in defense of Saddam Hussein. I was opposed to Saddam Hussein, and I left Iraq because of Saddam Hussein. But the reality that the sanctions hurt the Iraqi people, and also I call for a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on the basis of peace and justice, and the two peoples, the Palestinians and the Israelis, share this land. And third, I said that the Muslim world is part of what we call it in political science, the Global South, and they suffer from malnutrition, diseases, and many, many other problems, and let us solve these problems. Let us not allow terrorists to hijack Islam and to utilize it to recruit people to commit terrorist action. And after that, I received a call from a pastor of a church in Walnut, in the area, in Contra Costa County. And I did not see him before, and he came and he spoke with me and said, "We were impressed by what you said," and he invited me to his church. After that, I received invitations to more than 50 churches, schools, hospitals, even labor unions, and all of them were interested in knowing about Islam and in knowing about what is the position of the Muslim community. And I really represent the feeling of the Muslims, American Muslims in America. And for your own information, none of the terrorists who attacked the United States on 9/11 was American Muslim. Muslims enjoy this country, enjoy the prosperity of this country. And part of the tradition of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, used to make a supplication to God every day. He said, "Oh God, oh Allah, whatever bounty you bestowed on me or any of your creation is from you and from you alone, and I thank you for that. So we are told to thank God not for the bounties bestowed on us, but for the bounties bestowed on all the creation of God. And this country is a blessed country with the bounties from God, and it is our duty to thank God for that. I am gifted by having wonderful family, supportive family, and all my two sons and my daughter, they are successful. My son is vascular surgeon in Visalia, and he had training in Cleveland Clinic, and he had research work in Yale University, and he attended with me some of these meetings, and he came to me with the idea of the book. He said, "Dad, I found all the people you are talking to. They are interested in knowing about Islam. Why you don't try something, collect these questions and provide with your answers and present it to the American people. The American people would like to know about Islam. This is the true Islam. I depended on Quran and the tradition of Prophet Muhammad." And after the book was finished, I showed it to many Muslim scholars and they agree with me. So I will begin first by reading the basic, because I am requested to read part of the book. That is the tradition here when someone introducing his book would read, and then after that I would be open to discussion. Please, you will feel free to ask me any question, and I hope and sincerely hope to answer you the right answer and would build in the future on this communication and contacts. In writing about Islam, there is always need to state some basic principles and beliefs and clear up a few misconceptions. A colleague once asked me what 10 things I would want every American to know about Islam. And this list was eventually developed. There are two major sources of Islamic law and practices, the Quran and the Hadith. Muslims believe that the Quran, also spelled K, but I prefer the Q-U-R-A-N, but some people, they pronounce it or write it K-O-R-A-N, is a book of revelation. That contains the word of Allah, God, as conveyed to the Prophet Muhammad by the archangel Gabriel. The Hadith is a collection of sayings, stories, and rules attributed to the Prophet Muhammad and inspired by Allah. Allah means God, and God means Allah. Allah is the Arabic word for God. Muslims believe he is the same God, whether it is Muhammad's God or a Christian God or a Jewish God, it is simply means God. An Arabic Christian and an Arabic Muslim both use the same word for God. For example, the common word said by Arabs, Allah Ma'ak, literally means God be with you. Muslims don't worship Muhammad. He is a prophet and a messenger chosen by God. He is not immortal nor Superman. He was born, got married several times, had children, and died at the age of 63. Jesus is an important figure in Islam. Muslims believe he is the Messiah. He is neither God nor the Son of God. God created him via a virgin birth. He is an important messenger of Allah with special power to perform miracles. He never died. He ascended to heaven. Muslims like Christians are expecting his second coming. Islam rejects the doctrine of original sin or being born into sin. In Islam, all individuals are born without sin. And as individuals mature, their beliefs, deeds, and behaviors will be judged by God and God alone. Islam is based on five pillars or practices. Shahada, which means the declaration of the faith, or confession of the faith. And every Muslim says, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah wa ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah and that Muhammad is his messenger. This is the gate to enter Islam. Okay? Salah. Salah translates to prayers, but Salah. I am not reading from the book, but I am giving more explanation. Salah means, if you translate it literally, mean connection and connection with God. We Muslims believe when we stand in a prayers and we begin our prayers with the words Allahu Akbar, which means Allah is the greatest, and then we are communicating with God, with Allah. And this is why they call it Salah. Salah means connection, communication. Okay? The other fasting. And in the Quran, we call it Saum. But fasting in the Quran is referred to in connection with the Jews and the Christians. And it said in the Quran, O you who believe, fasting is prescribed for you as was prescribed for those before you. And in accordance with the interpretation of the Quran, those before us are the Christians and Jews. The other pillar of Islam is zakah, which translates into almsgiving. But almsgiving is not really the literal translation of zakah. Zakah means in Arabic purification. And this pillar of Islam is speaking about the purification of wealth by giving part of it to the poor and the needy. So, in order to purify your wealth, you have to give part of it to the poor and the needy. And the last pillar of Islam is Hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca. And Mecca, for your information, it is the first house built for worshiping God on earth. It was built by the prophet, we call him Ibrahim, you call him Abraham. Abraham is the father of all the prophets. And he and his son Ishmael, we call him in Arabic Ismail, built the Kaaba, or the house of worship in Mecca. So these are the five pillars, but I gave my explanation in the book. There are more to explain about this. Jihad. Where I receive always questions about what is jihad. Jihad literally means struggle. There are different types of jihad. The most important jihad in Islam is the struggle to control the evil temptation of the self. Jihad can also mean self-defense. For some, jihad also means holy war. However, many Muslim scholars, I am not considering myself a scholar, but many Muslims, including myself, don't believe or don't accept the concept of jihad as a holy war. Jihad is not one of the five pillars of Islam. Sharia is the Islamic religious law. It is to a certain extent similar to theology in Christianity and Judaism. As a matter of fact, I did not read it in the book, but Prophet Muhammad said there are great similarities between me and my brother Moses, because both of us came with rules of conduct to the society. Okay? Sharia deals with many aspects of religious and social life, including worship, family relation, and community affairs. Sharia requires Muslims to deal with non-Muslims in a just and fair manner. Sharia does not command Muslims to overthrow a non-Muslim government or to turn it into Sharia state. In the same manner, Muslims are not commanded to forcefully convert Christians or Jews to Islam. Number 9, there are two major sects of Islam, Sunni and Shiite. 90% of Muslims are Sunnis. There is no governing body of Sunni Muslims. Example, we don't have a pope. In Shiite Islam, there are imams who are the spiritual and religious leaders of the community. The word imam has two meanings. Imam in Sunni Islam is a community leader or a leader in a prayer. That's why people call me imam. I lead people in prayer, but I don't claim to be having a special power, or any person who leads others in a prayer could be called imam. But in order to lead people in a prayer, they should be well versed in the Quran, and they should be observant of the basic principles of Islam, because it is a major responsibility to lead people in the prayers. An imam in Shiite Islam is a descendant of Imam Ali, the fourth caliph. A Shiite imam is the spiritual and religious leader of Shiite Muslims everywhere. I will stop here because I want to give you a chance to ask me any question. Please don't hesitate to ask me questions. I am here to respond, and I will respond to your question faithfully and sincerely. And you are welcome. The floor is open, but speak loudly because I wear hearing aid. Yes, sir.
What is an Ayatollah?
Use the microphone, I think.
Pardon?
Yeah. I think it's good to use the microphone.
Okay. Ayatollah, literally translated, is the sign of Allah, sign of God. In Shiite Islam, they believe that when a person reaches such high stage in understanding Islam, in practicing Islam, in becoming a leader of the community, they would call him Ayatollah, which means the sign of Allah on earth. Yes. Any other question? Yes, ma'am.
Talk some more about the difference between Shiite and Sunni.
Okay, thank you very much. This is an important question because many people would like to know about it. First of all, I want to tell you that I am Sunni Muslim, but I respect the Shiite. I have no any sensitivity toward Sunnis or Shiites. No, we have to seek the truth. After the death of Prophet Muhammad, or even before his death, he did not assign any successor. The successor, we call him in Islam, Caliph. He did not assign any person to be the Caliph. This is in accordance with Sunni Islam. And the community met and they selected Abu Bakr as the first Caliph. And that was the consensus, although in accordance with Shiite Islam, that Abu Bakr usurped the Khilafat from Ali, the son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad. And they depend on certain hadith means speech or statement by Prophet Muhammad, to say, whoever accepts me as his master, Ali is his master. But in Sunni Islam, they said, Prophet Muhammad said also good things about Abu Bakr, Umar, others leaders. So this cannot be the judge or the judgment about who would succeed Prophet Muhammad. Later on, Ali himself gave bay'ah. In Islam, we call it bay'ah. Bay'ah means declaration of allegiance, like the elections here in America, that the community would come to the leader. And this happened 1430 years ago. And they went to Abu Bakr and say, we accept you as the caliph. Ali did that. And always I argue with my Shiite brothers. I said, if Ali agreed to Abu Bakr as the caliph, why you are raising this issue now? They said that he was shy, or he did not want to divide the ummah, or mean the nation. So if Ali did not want to divide the nation, why we are divided today? So the main issue is political. But the Shiite suffered. I must tell you, there were discriminations, and the populace in general, they have sympathy toward the Shiites. Why? Because they represented minority, and also the sentiment of the people in general, with those who would say, we are the descendant of Prophet Muhammad, we are the followers of Ali, the son and his daughter, and his wife Fatima, the daughter of Muhammad, so we are close to Muhammad, and we are discriminated against because of our faith. But that is not the reality. The reality is, when any ruler face challenge, they would try to eliminate the challenge to their rule. But what we hope for in the 21st century, that we should be above these differences. Now, who would say, I ask my Shiite brothers and sisters, okay, if we are all Muslims today, what difference it makes today if we say that Ali should have been the first caliph after Muhammad, or Abu Bakr was the rightly guided caliph after Muhammad? What difference does it make? Nothing. Let us respect the views of all of us. Every believer, even Muslims or non-Muslims, we believe we should respect the right of everyone to believe the way he thinks or she thinks about his or her own relations with God. And let us agree on solving the socio-economic, cultural, political problems, rather than to bring an issue which is 1400 years old to divide us today. In the meantime, I am a believer in democracy, and there is no contradiction between democracy. Not democracy like in Iran. In Iran, there is no democracy. But I believe in democracy as we are have it here in America or in Europe, the right of people to vote, freedom of expression, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, political parties, transparency, all these issues, I think, are consistent with Islam. And the best way for Muslims to go through the democratic rule. And this is, I am not saying it today. I wrote a paper in a conference in Washington, D.C. in 1993 of Muslims, American Muslim social scientists, and I say the democratization of the Islamic Ummah, which means nation, is the way for success. Okay? I hope I answered you. Yes, sir.
Could I ask you a question about Sharia law? I know there are some places in the world, parts of Africa particularly, where it's an issue where groups want to impose Sharia law on the population there. And I'm wondering what your view is of how Sharia can work within the context of a democratic system.
Yeah, I know that in Nigeria, for example, there are problems, and I was in Nigeria, and I know Nigeria very well. I work for democracy in Nigeria, so I know the story. I believe that any person who is trying to take the law in his hand or her hand, that is not acceptable, whether with respect to religion, social issue, or any other issue. People should not take the law in their hand. There are institutions, and through these institutions, we will have a better consensus in the society, and whether the society accepts the Sharia law or the Sharia law, like for example, with respect to the amputation of the hand of the thief. It is applied only in Saudi Arabia and some other few countries. But most of the Muslim countries, they are not renouncing Sharia, but they are saying that let us have a better understanding of the socio-economic problems which lead people to commit murder or theft or whatever. And I will give you from the history of Islam. The second caliph in Islam, his name Umar. And at that time, there was famine. And people began stealing and act in disorderly manner. And they brought some of the thieves, and they asked him, "Oh, caliph, we have to execute the judgment of God on them." He said, "I am the caliph, and I should provide the means for these people to live. If there is a famine and I cannot solve this problem, it is my responsibility to solve the problem first before amputating the hand of the thief." So even in the early days of Islam, there were some considerations about the circumstances of the crime committed and leniency and help to understand the condition of the crime. All these issues should be considered. So, again, if we have democracy and Islam, if we have people elected freely, and they would sit down. If the majority of people would like to have strict rules to punish the criminals, we will do it. Even once, I think a congressman here or senator, he was jokingly saying that let us apply Islamic Sharia. But I don't want people to think of Islamic Sharia in such a way that it is a harsh and considerable judgment which could anyone, any vigilante could come and apply. That is not the way we want Islam to be. And that is not the reality of Islam. Islam would like to build community, and we want to care about the community. That is more important than someone to come and say that he understands Islam and he wants to apply it the way he would like. This is my answer. I hope I satisfy you. Yes?
I have a question that's along similar lines in terms of the role of women.
Yeah.
Women in society and women as religious leaders in Islam. Is that something that's supported by most folks, American Muslims, or what's the position, would you say, that's most common?
Well, there are no women clergy. This is the reality. But in the meantime, the women search for knowledge, or women to be in a position of guiding people, it is consistent with Islam, even from the time of Prophet Muhammad. A wife of Prophet Muhammad named Aisha. And she was young, and she was very intelligent person. And she memorized 60,000 hadith of Prophet Muhammad. And Muhammad once said, take half of your religion from this reddish lady, because she had red hair. So, with respect to guidance, there is no problem with Muslim women to guide. As a matter of fact, I want to give you a secret. My wife brought me to Islam. I was Muslim, but she read the books of hadith and she said, we have children and they would grow up and you are their father. I was diplomat, concerned about diplomacy, traveling all over the world. She said, no, we should sit down and understand Islam and educate our children to be Muslims. So, the question of the role of women, there is exaggeration, but also there is a mixture between Islamic tradition and tribal tradition. Tribalism against women, because the survival for the fittest. Therefore, they would like to see people who would fight, and through their physical power, they could control the society or the community. But in Islam, women and men are equal with respect to their worship. Even yesterday, I gave Scott, a Jewish lady, is making a research on Islam. And she said that in the Quran, and she studied the Quran, and she learned Arabic now, she said there are always references to believing men and believing women, praying men and praying women. There is equality, but in inheritance, there is no equality. The men will get more because it is the responsibility of the men to provide for the family. And the wife could keep her inheritance. And even today, I told my wife when she received something from her family or I said, this is your money. She said, no, we will share it together. It is up to the woman to decide. Yes, sir.
Is there anything in Islam that may be similar to Judaism where there's an Orthodox part where, you know, women are not clergy and don't have roles as leaders, and then there's Reform and Conservative where, you know, they have more liberal
I was asked before about fundamentalism. In Islam, there is no fundamentalism. And this is injected on Islam, Islamic fundamentalism. There is no Islamic fundamentalism. But what is there? There are people in Islam who would use violence and who are extremists. There is differences between extremism and fundamentalism. Fundamentalism means to stick to the text. But extremism would like to use violence or try to oppress others and to let their views to be prevailing. And that is against Islam. But the division of Muslims into Orthodox or liberals or reformists, That is, I don't accept that, because all of us, we are working in accordance with the Quran and the Hadith, and it is the same Quran and Hadith for every Muslim. And even I will tell you from the life of Prophet Muhammad, once a Bedouin came to Prophet Muhammad, and this is part of the Hadith, we learn it and we take it as a guideline for our work. And he told him, "Oh Muhammad, I will pray only the 5 obligatory prayers, and I don't have money to spend to the poor and the needy, and I will fast in Ramadan, and that is all what I will do. Do you think Allah will accept me?" He said, "If you do it sincerely, Allah will accept you." So even these simple things, to pray, fast in Ramadan, and give charity, even Prophet Muhammad said, if you have nothing, give half a date. You know what is date? The fruit, the small fruit. He said, if you don't have anything, share a date with your brother or sister. And in addition to that, he said, even if you don't have a half a date, a good word is a charity. Okay, ma'am, you have.
Yes, I'm having troubles with the equality that you're speaking of with men and women. When I think of the stoning of women for adultery, where men are not held responsible for that, where women are shielded from selling in markets often, where they're wearing burqas, where they have to go, I saw a documentary, I can't remember what country it was, where the women in secret went to unite and support each other because of the sexism that Islam has. And I'm not talking about American Islam, Muslims, because of course in this society people are exposed. I mean, we have all kinds of communication in this society. But I'm talking about the origins of Islam. And I want to like Islam. I do Sufi dancing, and I read Rumi, and it's beautiful poetry. And then I read about the sexism that reigns in Islam, and I think if the males in the Middle East are still doing these things to women, how can there possibly ever be peace? Because it starts at home.
Okay.
And also I had another question about the jihad, when you said that you did not believe in it.
No, I did not say I don't believe in jihad.
No, said
I said jihad, I don't believe that jihad is
holy
war.
And others do not either. Well, then my question is, where does the jihad come from? And then the man back there has talked about the Ayatollah, who is an elevated figure in Islam, and he put that thingamajigger on the satanic verse man, Rushdie. And another man that I think he was a European Dutch or somebody that was doing cartoons. And so those things are the things that filter down to me as just one little American person in Santa Cruz trying to have a peaceful heart. And when I see the rage and then I read about the things that are happening to women, it's difficult for me to listen to you because it seems like you're fluffing everything over.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I know you're a peaceful man. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, probably most of the Muslims here are peaceful. But it doesn't seem to me that they're peaceful in their homes in the Middle East.
No.
All I can
say. Okay. You raised so many questions. And let me take some of them, if my memory would not betray me. Okay, first of all, whether in the Middle East or here, Muslims, the family I grew up in, my father respected my mother, and they have very, and my father did not have only one wife, my mother. And my mother was really a decision maker in the family. And I learned from her a lot. And she took me to schools, and she had Jewish friends, Christian friends. Even when I was born, a Jewish lady helped her, and I was born in my house, not in hospital or in a clinic or anywhere, and a Jewish lady was there, and my mother used to remind me of your other mother, her name Sabiha. Okay, so there are differences in the Middle East or elsewhere, but not related to Islam, related to tribal societies or modern societies. In the Middle East, still we have tribalism. And this is the cause of many of the problems in the Middle East with respect to women. And as for the chador, or dress in Iran, or burqa, I spoke about it. This is not part of Islam. And I wrote it in the book, and this is my responsibility.
What is it?
It is tribal tradition. It is tradition in Afghanistan and Iran.
Except the women in France wanted to cover their heads.
Yeah, no. Let me explain. In Islam, in accordance with the commandments of God, as interpreted by the Prophet, women should cover their body up to the hands, and they should keep their face, and the hair should be covered. And I always ask my Christian friends, have you ever seen Virgin Mary without a cover of her hair? Have you seen her? There is no picture for Virgin Mary without head cover. All the wives, daughters, mothers of the prophets, from Muhammad, Mary, Moses, all of them, they use the same dress code. They cover their body up to here, and they keep their face up, open. There are a group of people who would like to cover up to the eyes, and really I sympathize with the French authorities and others. Why? Because this is a security issue. It is a security issue. How could somebody would take a plane and had all her body covered with the exception of the eyes. So this is not Islamic. In Islam, the face and the hands should be kept without cover. But these are traditions, and I hope through education, through dialogue, understanding, they would give up these things. My wife wears a scarf, and she wore up to here, but she is modern lady, and she drive a car and act like any normal person. My daughter told me, Dad, I am working in a business firm and I cannot wear this scarf. I said, here in America, I said, this is up to you if you don't want to do it. But when she prays, she covers her hair and keeps only her hand without cover and the face. Okay, did I answer you?
I have one other question. How many times a day do Islams, five times a day?
Yeah.
Do women do that also?
But yes.
They're obliged to also. And are women segregated in mosques?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Why is that? Because the prayers in Islam, standing, bowing, standing and sitting and all these things, they don't want the bodies of people to touch each other. But that is not out of disrespect. In the meantime, I want to tell you that in Mecca, the most important mosque in Islam, there is no segregation of men and women.
Yay.
Yes, sir.
If I understand it correctly, Islam is connected to Abraham.
Pardon?
If I understand you correctly, Islam is connected, they recognize Abraham and they recognize Jesus.
Yeah.
So where did all the rails?
Pardon?
Well, they recognized the Jewish people.
Yeah.
And they recognized Jesus for what he represented. The Middle East, it sounds like every Jew that lives in Jerusalem or Israel and all the Arab, they're just, there's no, I mean, that's a horrible war between the two of them. Where did all that go wrong if they all were connected?
Okay.
And then one other question this woman rose that was very good, but I think what you're saying is sincere in the sense that Islam is a people of a belief, and the tribalism gets all screwed up. So it sounds like unless Islam gets its act together, then how are we ever going to have peace with this thing?
Okay. In Islam, Prophet Muhammad said, each prophet came to his nation or to his tribe. Except me, I came to humanity, he said, to all mankind. And I will tell you why. When Moses went to the Pharaoh, he did not tell him to accept Judaism or to be believing in God. He told him, let my people go. Is that correct? So the Judaism came to the 12 tribes from Moses. Moses carried the principles of the Torah, and even in the Quran there is a verse saying وَفَضَّلْنَا بَنِي إِسْرَائِيلَ عَلَى الْعَالَمِينَ. We gave preference to the people of Israel over all the peoples of the world. But that was at the time when they were carrying the Torah. When Jesus Christ came, he was within the Israelite family because his mother is a Jew, was a Jew. And therefore he came, in our opinion, in our Islamic interpretation, he came to update the faith. So, Jesus came as a continuation. Muhammad came as continuation. But I will tell you, in Islam, in the Quran, there is a verse which says, argue not with the people of the book, which means the Christians and Jews, except in good manner, and except with those who oppress you or do you wrong, and say to them, our God and your God is one, and to whom we submit in Islam. So we are forbidden even from arguing with the Jews or with the Christians. But when they do wrong to us, we have to respond. And Jews lived in the Arab world, and I will tell you, in Andalusia, many Jewish historians say the era of the Andalusia, the Islamic rule in Spain, was the golden era of Jewish history in Europe. Jews were assigned to government position, they were dealt with respect, and they were part of the society. That was the Islamic model for the relationship between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. Okay?
So
yes.
What the
main difference is, I don't want to speak about politics, the oppression of the Palestinians. Let us solve the Arab-Israeli conflict on the basis of peace and justice, and there will be no differences between Jews and Muslims.
Yeah. I missed most of your talk. You might have already covered this, but I'm curious about Wahhabism. Is that peculiar to Sunni, or does it overlap all the other branches?
Okay. Wahhabism is related or originated from a person called Muhammad Abdul Wahhab. And Muhammad Abdul Wahhab had an agreement with the founder of the Saudi monarchy. And they agreed that the Saudi royal family would lead the state. And Muhammad Abdul Wahhab and his followers would lead the religion. So they were given tremendous power from the Saudi family on one condition, that they should not object to the action of the government. For example, in 1991, when the United States sent 500,000 troops to fight Iraq, many Muslim leaders, they said that a Muslim land should not be used to attack another Muslim country. But the religious leadership in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis, said, no, that is good, because that is from the king, and the king is the representative of God on earth. That is nothing to do with Islam. Wahhabism is having very narrow interpretation of Islam, and they have the support of the government of Saudi Arabia, and therefore I don't consider them representing the Islam I believe in.
But could you be a Sunni Wahhabi?
The Wahhabis are Sunnis, but there are four Sunni schools, and not only schools of thought, but not only that, but it is the interpretation of Islam is taking very rigid calls. For example, the Wahhabis are preventing women from driving. There is nothing in Islam about preventing women from driving.
Okay, I said that wrong. I meant to say, can you be a Shia Wahhabi?
There is no Shia Wahhabis.
So
you can be Shiite or Wahhabi, you cannot be both.
So it's, Wahhabism is exclusively...
Wahhabism is a branch of Islam prevailing in Saudi Arabia. It is based on one school of thought, they call it Hanbali, Ahmed bin Hanbal, who gave interpretation to Islam, and then Muhammad Abdul Wahhab followed that. But the problem with the Wahhabi movement, that it is linked to the Saudi royal family, and they were given power by the Saudi royal family on condition that they should not intervene in the policies of the government. Okay, you wanted to...
I was just going to make a quick comment. Like, Israel-Palestine thing isn't really so much about religion. It was more about the UN and how the UN came in and took the housing from Palestine and split it up. So if you actually want to know more about that, there's a really good book called The Lemon Tree, and it really breaks that down and pulls it apart
okay.
from religion.
Okay,
thank you. Dr. Amir, I'm curious where your doctorate is from, and what did you study for the doctorate?
I'm at the State University of New York.
And the subject?
International relations.
Okay. Well, it wasn't Islamic studies, but that's understandable. I'm not criticizing that.
Could you speak up?
I'm not criticizing. I asked him where his doctorate was from, and it's New York State University in International Relations, okay, which explains why you were employed at the United Nations. I've also taken a religious journey in life.
Mm-hmm.
I was born into a Catholic family in mm-hmm. a Catholic tradition. And I intellectually escaped from that, as have millions of others. I escaped from the oppression, the intellectual oppression of fundamentalist religion based on mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for example, at page 23 of your book,
mm-hmm.
you indicate the Prophet Muhammad meditated in the caves near Mecca.
Yeah.
And while meditating, he had the vision from the Archangel Gabriel, who spoke to him and commanded him to read.
Yeah.
And then you indicate that Muhammad was able to memorize for 23 years the Quran, even though he was illiterate.
Yeah.
Sir, to assert in the Christian tradition yeah. that there is any proof for a reasoned, thinking person
yeah.
familiar with modern science and observation
yeah.
that there was ever an Angel Gabriel who appeared to anyone. Now, I will accept, I know there are
no,
other dimensions.
It
that
is up to you. You
no,
can
no, no,
accept
no, no,
it or reject
it. Here's my thrust of my question. Then at page 58, you indicate that of the principles of 40 hadiths
yeah.
in Islam, 39b is do not ever oppress anyone.
Yeah.
Now, women, and then lastly, at page 59, you indicate, our shared history as Americans has taught us that individual respect and honest dialogue are our greatest strengths. Yeah. Okay, and the American tradition. Now, contrary, the tradition, the preachings of all of the major Islams, the current mullahs, is contrary to the American tradition and respect for democracy. Now let's come back to oppression. Let's come back to the horrible oppression inflicted on women. The horrible oppression is based on nonsense, sir.
No,
and
sir.
You have a doctorate. This is based on a fraud, just like others.
Please.
And the worst example, the oppression. I came here to have an honest dialogue.
If you come here to a disruptive meeting.
Why are women murdered by Islam so often?
Please, if you come here to disrupt the meeting.
No, I came here.
No, you came to disrupt the meeting.
No, I didn't.
Because the way you are talking to me is not intellectual dialogue. You are shouting at me, and I have to shout on you in order to stop you from doing this.
All right, could you answer my question?
Give the chance to others. You are not engaged in constructive dialogue. Yes, ma'am.
I heard you earlier today, and I have to say that I hope you listen to your friends who tell you that there were no Muslims involved in 9/11, and in fact,
Please speak loudly. I cannot hear you.
I was told. I'm married to a Muslim, by the way. And I have something to say. The women who are Muslims, they have the choice to choose. There is a reason why they are covered, is to protect themselves. So they're not looked at and gawked at by men. You look once, it's fine. You look twice, it's the same. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Yes, sir.
We have time for one more question.
Yes, two questions.
Okay, two more.
Yes, sir.
I'm bringing your viewpoint on you.
I'm there.
Can we hear you?
I'm hearing your viewpoint of what's happening this very second.
I'm here.
Repeat, please.
I'm here.
Because I want to hear.
No, I understand. I couldn't hear him either.
Yes, sir. You want any? Yes, sir.
Did you want to answer his question?
What's happening in Libya?
What's happening in Libya?
Okay, in Libya and in Egypt and in Tunisia, this is uprising, and this is a true people's movement. It is nonviolent. The violence was committed by the government forces, and particularly in Egypt, they brought thugs to attack peaceful demonstrators, and they are peaceful. They don't believe in violence. They want to end the corruption, and I wrote an article in the Contra Costa Times criticizing the position of our government, the United States of America, because while President Obama is speaking about democracy, respect for human rights, etc., etc., but he was reluctant to support the Egyptian uprising. Why? Because certain vested interest, Mubarak was the friend of the United States and Israel, and they don't want to harm his position. But these are genuine movement by the people, peaceful, and we hope there will be democratic transformation in Egypt with the freedom to all. And contrary to what you heard before, Muslims and Christians, they said, the cross and the Quran, hand by hand, they were walking in the Al-Tahrir Square. I think, and I believe all of you have seen it. And that is contrary to the propaganda that Muslims and the Christians are fighting in Egypt. This is not true. I saw it in my eyes. The Christians holding the cross and the Muslims holding the Quran, and they are demanding democracy and respect for human rights.
In Alexandria. Mention the Alexandria.
Pardon?
Mention Alexandria, because so many people here heard about.
Yeah, and also I read on on the internet, and I verified with my Egyptian friends that the attack in Alexandria against the two churches, which the government claimed that Muslim fundamentalists or whoever, now the interior minister of Hosni Mubarak is being investigated now because the government had hands in this. Why? Because they want to tell the United States that if you allow this uprising to continue, Muslims would come and they would kill the Christians, and that is wrong. That would not happen. Muslims and the Christians will live in Egypt as brothers and sisters. Yes, sir.
One more.
Before I ask my question, if I can, just to add to that, shortly thereafter, after the religious Christians have celebrate Christmas after we traditionally in December 25th, and as they were celebrating in the church in Egypt, Muslims surrounded the entire church saying that we're going to protect you while you're celebrating your feast. But my question is this. Of the, and thank you very much for your enlightenment. Your thoughts on why of the over 120,000 prophets, Prophet Isa was the one endowed with raising the dead, healing the sick, being born as Adam. Why of all of the prophets other than Adam would he be the one selected with these attributes from an Islamic point of view?
What?
Jesus?
Could you come closer?
Of all the prophets, why was Jesus endowed with certain miraculous powers that the other prophets didn't have?
Similar to Adam.
No. Adam, in accordance with the Quran, Adam was taught by Allah all the names. And Adam was able to memorize them. And even Allah preferred Adam over the angels. Because in the Quran, Allah asked the angels to bow to Adam. And they said, why we should bow to him? And we are engaged in praising you all the time. He said, I know better than what you know. And he taught him the names. But Adam committed a sin. But the differences between the Muslims and the Christians with respect to the sin of Adam, Adam asked forgiveness from God, and God is forgiving God, and he forgave Adam.
No, I realize. Why was Jesus given the powers of raising the dead, healing the sick, etc., etc.?
Well, we don't want to question why God is doing this, but it is part of the wisdom
I'll tell you
of
later.
This is part of the wisdom of God. Yes, sir, because you raised your hand several
times. Last question.
If I can turn to perhaps a non-controversial, but to ask a question, information. What are the Islamic views about nature?
About
nature.
About the natural world.
Environmentalism and nature. Relationship to nature.
In the Quran, there are many verses which say, ask a human being, go and look at the creation of God. Go and look at the creation of God. Which means to appreciate the creation of God. And the Prophet Muhammad was always commanding Muslims not to hurt nature, to protect the environment, to protect the trees and everything in the universe. Even animals are protected. And there is a story in the tradition of Prophet Muhammad. He was speaking about a man who was in the desert, and that man saw a dog, and the dog was about to die. And that man went to a well, and he did not have any vessel or anything to bring water. He put water in his shoe, and he gave it to that dog. And in accordance with the story, as narrated by Prophet Muhammad, that man would be rewarded with paradise because he saved a dog. So this is about saving animals, saving the humanity, protecting the environment. It is all consistent with Islam. Thank you very much.
Thank you. No, we're going to end because Dr. Elaine has to drive back to Walnut Creek tonight, and she's been here since this morning. So we're going to end. If you you want to talk to him, buy a book, support the book cafe, that'd be terrific. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.